Fourth Note Podcast. Today was a good one, Nico.
It was. It was a lot of fun.
So today we talked to Jim Dreyfuss and Blake Modrzycki. We won't even go over their intros. They go through that themselves during the podcast. But this was just super fun.
It was a lot of fun. I think, you know, there's a lot of conversation about the early days of venture all the way to today, which it was kind of fun to see that web be woven. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, as we go through all of these different podcasts and we kind of start back from the 70s and 80s and work our way forward, I think it's important for listeners to know what the venture environment looked like or didn't look like. You know, back in the 80s, there was no VC. You know, Jim got going in the mid 80s with a $3 million fund. Whereas today, you know, entrepreneurs are used to, there's a million ways to raise money. Even from when I started in 2003, the fundraising venture landscape is completely different in Utah.
Well, I think the thing that was most surprising to me is Jim talked about his first few investments being life sciences, and then there being a turning point, which was an unfortunate turning point, but a turning point into more of the computer sciences. And even for me, as I was thinking about venture back in those days, it was wildly different as far as what they were investing in as well.
Yeah. That's probably what I'll take from today's conversation is, you know, Jim's now retired. Blake's running Pelion. The two of them, you know, Jim is really the godfather of Utah venture. Mm-hmm. And then he kind of passed the keys, you know, over the last decade or so to Blake at Pelion. But you know, hearing Jim talk about some of his favorite investments, it wasn't necessarily the IRR, how much money he made. It was the good that they did for the world.
Yeah. As he talked about, which we'll hear about the hearing aid company, you could tell how excited he was that they were part of such innovation.
Yeah. And some fun stories, you know, just like it feels like every guest, you know, one little different decision or little, you know, circumstance not happening. Mm-hmm. And Jim Dreyfuss maybe never starts UV Partners and venture is completely different in Utah. So he you know, that's a fun story that they talked through as well.
Yeah. It'll be a fun one.
Let's go. Well, we've got Blake Modrzycki, Jim Dreyfuss. We need to start with just intros. Blake, why don't you go first? Just tell us how you got to where you're at now.
Well, yeah, it was a fun journey. So, came out of college, went to work for WordPerfect, moved to the East Coast, and then to Seattle. Then through that process, Novell acquired WordPerfect, so I ended up at Novell. And then there was a guy named Eric Schmidt who created a corporate venture fund called Novell Ventures. And I was given the opportunity to step in and work there and then eventually run that, from 96 to 2002. Then Eric left and went to this little startup called Google. Now, if you guys all remember what Google looked like in 2002, it was a little dicey.
Yeah.
So I opted not to go with Eric. That'd be a big mistake. And I joined my partner, Jim Dreyfuss, at what was Utah Ventures. So That's been my journey into this world of venture capital, and you know, and it's been an amazing journey. So that's me, Jim. What's your background?
I was born in Salt Lake, grew up here, went away to college, and then ended up going to New York City, working for Bankers Trust, which doesn't exist anymore. And I was in the workout group, so all the loans that were tough needed to be turned around, and then I went from there to San Francisco, where I was on the commercial paper and LBO side of Bankers Trust. We were pushing Glass-Steagall. We were offering, we did the first selling of commercial paper for Intel. Mm. And we bought Safeway and a couple other LBOs. And I came back to Salt Lake to help my father who got cancer and got bored. And about 6 months after I got back here, Wayne Brown approached me. Wayne was the dean of the engineering school at the University of Utah. Said we needed a venture capital company. And he was joined by a guy named Dick Shaneman from the financial services side. And they said it would take us 90 days to raise $15 million. And it took me 15 months to raise $3,939,000. And that was the creation of Utah Technology Venture Fund, which is now Pelion.
Wow. So Wayne Brown, was his motivation to help students have funding for their ideas?
No, I don't think so. He had started a company called Kenway Engineering, which was Ken Richens and Wayne Brown. and they were the first automated warehouse moving company. So he computerized and moved everything in warehouses. So that was based in Salt Lake City. He saw the success of David Evans at E&S. He saw what Venrock did coming into E&S as the first investor. He saw that University of Utah had a lot of technology that wasn't being commercialized. He thought it would be good to have a seed fund here, which then could attract other entrepreneurs and mainly money, other venture funds. So we went out and tried to raise money from the normal places, institutions, foundations, wealthy individuals, family offices. And I got two boxes of turndown letters. I was introduced.
I think we still have those letters, by the way.
Okay. They're probably in a story. I don't throw anything away. I'm old fashioned. And then I was introduced to Peter Chris from Venrock. And Venrock came in and committed to the fund. And we had 10 venture funds as limited partners. They were all looking for early stage investments in Utah.
Give us 30 seconds background on Venrock. I know a little bit about Venrock, but they're really, really kind of started VC, not just in Utah, but in the Bay Area, right?
Based in New York originally, okay. Like all of them. And so it was a spin out of the Rockefeller family. And they were looking at different ways to invest their capital. I mean, if in today's dollars, John D. Rockefeller Senior would be worth almost $800 billion today. Wow. So it's kind of crazy. So this family decided that they wanted to go out and see what else was new. They hired a man named Peter Crisp out of Harvard Business School. He created the fund. He came into me, but his other investments were E&S was here, Native Plants was here, 10% of Apple. He was on the board of Apple for many years. They're sort of a who's who of Silicon Valley, but most of them were still based on the East Coast then. And so he came in, and then 10 other venture funds came in, H&Q, Morgan Thaler, NEA, Excel.
Berrigan Deliage. Continental Illinois.
Centennial. It's funny, Pelion outlasted most of them.
So what year is this where you're forming?
85.
Okay.
So, and there were probably at the NVCA meeting that year, there were probably about 300 people that represented all the venture capital in America.
Wow. So 85.
85, and then our first investment was 86.
So Larry Miller's still buying his first few dealerships. Yeah. Bruce and Alan are really starting to hit their stride with WordPerfect. Novell's brand new. What was your investment thesis? Like, what kind of companies were you looking for? There wasn't a lot of pattern matching for you to kind of go off of like, oh, here's what makes good venture investments. Like, what did you start with?
I had no idea. So we have a history. The University of Utah had a history of life sciences. So you had a group of doctors here that were in material science and also in blood chemistry. You had the doctor from Europe come over here and do kid dialysis machines, Dr. Kolf. You had the heart being produced, artificial heart being done here. So we were looking at early stage technologies out of the University of Utah that could be seeded by Pelion, Utah Ventures at the time. And then we could bring in our co-investors and or other ones.
You know, Jim, I think one of the interesting stories for everybody is Sonic Innovation. You actually got the University of Utah and BYU to work together.
And we did a bunch of, it was interesting. Utah really had some breakthrough technologies. One of them was the digital hearing aid. So now everybody talks about,
right?
Yeah.
Tom Stockham was from the University of Utah. Was one of the founders of digital sound. Tom Stockham was hired by the U.S. government, not hired, but told to decipher the Watergate tapes. And so he had an idea for digital recordings for in the ear using that thing. A guy named Doug Shabrias at BYU had done some work in the eyes. They got together and myself originally, and then Tom and Doug Shabrias and a man named Carver Mead from Caltech, who was going to miniaturize it because it was on a supercomputer at BYU when we tested it. it was digitizing all sound that goes into an ear.
Wow.
And all hearing aids now in the world are digital.
And Jim, if I remember, it was like $35,000 investment. Is that what it was into your first investment into Sonic?
No, I think it was like $75,000.
And
then then 2 million, then Venrock came in, Morgenthaler came in, NEA came in, and then Goldman Sachs took us public.
Wow, you're reminding me of a tweet. I don't know if it was by Mark Andreessen or someone. It was in the last couple of months, and I never realized this, but you know, venture capital today is all about returns and what deal you can get into and public, you know, IPOs, whatever. Originally, what venture was amazing at and what it brought to the world is it drove life sciences. It drove that, you know, technology forward very, very quickly back in the 70s and 80s.
And computer sciences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you got to remember, I mean, the value of money, you're all younger than I. but the first $1 billion acquisition was when General Electric bought Utah Construction in 1980 for $1 billion.
I've never even heard of that.
And Utah Construction was a construction company that also had lots of mining properties. So they were big in Australia. They were big in South America. It started in Ogden. It was run out of San Francisco. Mm. But General Electric, and it was the largest acquisition in the history of the world when it was made in 1980.
Wow.
Mm. And that's 60 years ago.
Well,
now we're talking about valuations of companies in the trillions.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole value of money, when I said, you know, we had almost 3.9 million and then we took the fund to 15 million, then to 60. Blake knows the numbers better than I.
It's the first deal you did then. Very first deal. You got your 3.9 million. Do you remember your first deal?
I do, exactly.
What was it?
International. I did Vapor Fab. It was coding pieces of airplanes to evade radar detection with nickel carbonyl. And we sold it to International Nickel about a year and a half later. And that's when I raised a new fund.
Did you make money on it?
We made three times our money.
Wow. In a year and a half.
In a year and a half. But we only had 150 grand into it. So now it's the value of money, right?
That was almost 5% of the fund. That's a big check.
But we, we had, I think, 8 public offerings in the first one.
Yeah. Fund one for this firm was literally one of the most successful funds of all time and of that era. The number of IPOs, as Jim said, I think half the companies went public. Well, you had like 15 or 16 companies in the portfolio. And half of them went public.
That's insane.
How many were in Utah? Were most of them outside?
Anesta was in Utah. I was drug delivery through the mouth. That company's product sells about $2.5 billion in product sales a year. Sonic was in Utah.
Right.
Iomed drug delivery transdermal patches were delivered here. I think about half.
Okay.
Yeah. I think about half.
So was this fund mostly outside of the computer sciences? It sounds like the couple that you rattled off for life sciences, I mean, I don't even know.
Pretty much outside until one of the questions you had asked was what tragedy did you go through or what happened? So my first partner, Wayne Brown, who was dean of the engineering school, I was sitting at home one night and John Scowcroft called me and said, I want you to know the news before you see it on the news tonight. And he had crashed his airplane. And I'm 31 or 32 at the time. I'm running the fund by myself. Didn't know what I was going to do. And about 2 weeks later, I approached David Evans, who was then CEO of Evans and Sutherland. And as we went away from Wayne and into David, that's when we sort of went away from life sciences into computer sciences. So it was something that I did not contemplate and say, we're going into computer science. It was a
forced thing almost.
It was a life event. You know, Wayne's such an icon. I mean, there's still the Wayne Brown Institute here in town. And he was a private pilot and just an amazing individual. I never knew him. I just heard stories through Jim, but you know, he was killed in this private plane crash, and Jim had a 12-month walkabout, and then with David Evans, and that kind of catapulted version, the next story of Utah Ventures.
That's crazy. So how long into your tenure as a venture capitalist did this happen?
2 years.
Okay.
Two,
so two it's still a, pretty new. Two and still a half pretty years. Fresh.
Yeah. A 2 year old baby and a 2 year old crash.
Explain what the funding environment was like. Maybe this question is for both of you, going back to the 80s and 90s. I started my first company in 03, so I can kind of tell. I know what it was like from that point forward. And it was hard in 03. Like, you know, there was a bunch of old mean guys that called themselves the Utah Angels that would just beat the crap out of you. And if you survived getting crap kicked out of you, maybe they would give you money. It was hard. You guys were 10, 15, 20 years before that. Like we heard, you know, we heard from Novell, like a $750K check from Ray Norda is kind of what got that thing going. And Alan Ashton talked to us about they couldn't find anyone to give them money just to buy a computer. That's all they wanted. They didn't need like snacks for employees and billboards. They needed a computer. So what was the, just talk a little bit about what it was like.
Yeah. You know, what I'll say was, first of all, getting any, I mean, Jim was successful in getting the, you know, these 10 venture firms to invest, but man, we couldn't give away ski tickets, free weekends, nothing to get anybody to come and look at deals here. So the funding environment was really hard.
Yeah.
I think on top of that, you had, the entrepreneurial community was just very different back in the 90s and probably in the 80s. It was a really small group of people. And the other thing that I would say is that's very different as compared to today is they'd start a company and let's sell it for $20 or $30 million. Mm-hmm. Well, making venture returns is very hard. You know, Jim mentioned Utah Construction. Well, the families behind Utah Construction are the Eccles family, the Quinney family, the Dumpkes, and the Dees. They're all Utah people.
Yeah.
So it they figured it out. So I think it was hard to get money to come to Utah. And I think it was also just the whole entrepreneurial ecosystem was, let's start a company, sell it for $20 or $30 million, and then we'll move on to the next thing.
Yeah. The thing I would like to add also is we didn't have the depth of people.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have the tech law firms.
Yeah.
You didn't have anybody in the accounting services. The MBAs that wanted to go and learn technology coming out of Stanford or wherever else wanted to be in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or they wanted to be in Boston, or they wanted to be maybe in Chicago. And so we were, you know, there was that old map. It showed New York and California, and it showed sort of a little state of Utah, and everybody was flying over us, but no one was stopping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we needed the economy of scale. We needed some successes. You had the ENS, you had the Word Perfect, you had the Novells, you had the spinoffs from those.
Yeah.
And once you had the spinoffs, once you had, you know, some of the things in the life sciences, then that attracted people, and those people liked it when they got here. They wanted to recycle into companies here, and they stayed here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, but I think, you know, what has happened in the last decade as far as the people and the infrastructure is light years ahead of where it's ever been.
It's absolutely magic because if you, like, as Jim said, out of the University of Utah or BYU or Utah State, like any of the universities, the graduates, yeah, they weren't interested in starting companies. They mm-hmm. were interested in going to work for Ford Motor Company right. or Goldman Sachs. Yep. That wasn't part of the equation where today, you know, that's everybody wants to be an entrepreneur.
Yep.
That didn't exist. So it's a whole mind shift that's happened in this last decade.
Yeah. And a lot of it, I mean, Blake, you were at both of these companies. I think a lot of this maturation that the Silicon Slopes area has gone through, we owe to Word Perfect and Novell for those, you know, for Ray Norda, for Alan Ashton, for Bruce, for staying here and building here and teaching. Because now, if you need a CFO that knows how to go public, there are options. Yep. Back then, everybody was making it up.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, like Evans and Sutherland, I think, you know, there was a lot of good things that kind of impacted Ray and Alan and Bruce and all those guys when they created that company. But it was, like, I went to work for both of them. It was still like technology one was a real novelty in general and what it was going to look like and the impact on the world. I don't think any of us had any idea.
Still forming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was like, okay, so this whole word processing thing, I got a typewriter. I'm still good.
Yeah. You know,
that's kind of how people viewed it.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, the difference between computer sciences and life sciences back then. The life sciences seemed to grow up and then get sold to somebody bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Sorensen sold to Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
Anesta goes public and gets sold to Cephalon. you had the independence of WordPerfect and Novell and ENS that stayed as Utah companies. That really attracted a lot of other people.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the venture environment. So kind of when I started my first company in 03. Blake, you joined Pelion in 02. Vspring was brand new. Epic, like there I think was when there started to be maybe a little competition. Maybe talk about, you know, maybe start with you, Jim. That evolution of like, oh, there's actually more venture funds here with maybe a little bit of competition. That's also when Omniture, Qualtrics, Pluralsight, you know, this company Entrada we're sitting in, that's when they were all started. Like maybe just talk a little bit about what kind of happened to all of a sudden propel us into what I think was the beginning of this, you know, current phase we're in.
While you're thinking, Jim, I'll give it a shot here. So like when you think back on that, you know, Jim was like the solar practitioner for probably a decade here or longer. You know, Novell's venture fund in 96, that was a pretty novel thing. I mean, there was Intel Capital and that was kind of it. Mm-hmm. And the brains behind Novell Ventures was Eric Schmidt. Mm-hmm. You know, because he'd started, he was the brains behind the Java fund that he'd started at Sun Microsystems. It was managed by Ted Schlein at Kleiner. Oh.
Was Novell Ventures an actual fund or was you just investing off the balance sheet?
Off the balance sheet. I was a Novell employee, but it was a captured pool of capital inside. Okay. And Eric and a guy named Carl Ledbetter, they were my investment committee. That's who I worked for. And then I think you had a couple of these successes, you know, like with Vspring and some things that Greg Warnock had done and a few of the other partners there had had some success. They want to try to put something together, you know, with Wasatch, now Epic. They had the support of Zions Bank. And that was kind of it. And so I'm not sure I'd call it competition. It was just like maybe a couple more checkbooks here in town. Yeah, but we were still challenged with the same challenge that we had. And that is to actually get capital from outside to come and look at things. And then you had the, you know, what Josh did with Omniture and Butterfield did with Altiris. And like a lot of these different things that rolled through here, I think started to garner some attention from the outside world.
Was that the turning point, Omniture and Altiris? It feels like it was to me, but you know, I wasn't deeply involved.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, it again, you for the first time, you had the economy of scale of people and money and ideas and spinoffs from the universities, BYU and the University of Utah, and it was the perfect storm.
Yeah.
And I don't think the big investors from the coast were scared about coming in here anymore because they could see that there was money to be made and that the people were interested in staying here and doing second and third and fourth startups.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole environment changed.
Well, you know, and I think part of that is when Eric's vision with Novell Ventures was we'd made direct investments and then we also invested into venture funds as a limited partner.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Not in me, though.
As I said to you guys earlier, Jim took him honoring. and you know, if you think about Altiris for just a minute, you know, so I was an investor in a firm called TCV, Technology mm-hmm. Crossover Ventures. Altiris actually competed with Novell's ZenWorks. And so Greg Butterfield and Jan Newman, those guys, good friends, they called on the phone. And I just, look, I as an investor at Novell, I can't invest in a competitor to Novell.
Right.
But I know a couple friends. So I actually introduced those guys to Jay Hoag over at TCV. Mm-hmm. And TCV was who invested into Altiris. And so I think if you look at the model that Jim had with Utah Ventures and the 10 venture funds that were coming to town, Venrock, Morgan Thaler, all mm-hmm. those guys. And then you kind of roll forward to what the vision with Novell Ventures and that putting money into venture funds, they started to come to town to visit,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you had, and like, it was interesting. So one of the first things I did when I got connected with Jim was actually through a guy named Jim Schwartz, who's the founder of Excel Partners. Right. That's mm-hmm. how I met Jim Dreyfus. Well, the seafood buffet during the holidays that was put on by Jim Schwartz and Bob Pavey at Morgan Thaler that brought all the VCs to town. And we all had dinner together up in, was it Stein Erickson? Deer Valley Lodge. And those guys started to kind of feel the energy back then. And I think, I think it was a decade of a lot of pick rock and mining that Jim did. And then the next generation was, we kept bringing them to town. And you know, roll forward. And look, they would never come to town without what the entrepreneurs have done. So the credit definitely goes to the entrepreneurs here in town.
Well, and but I wouldn't skip over you guys. Look, Jim, he never invested in any of my companies either, by the way.
But he you two are killing me.
he introduced me to people. Like, you knew everybody.
Yeah.
You always knew everyone. I think that that's something I don't want to skip over. I think people need an appreciation for that. And Jim, I know you're the same way. You guys, I would just assume, talk about this. You worked your butts off to just drive awareness and meet people. Like, to this day, if I ever need to meet anybody, Blake's one of the first people I text to see if you know him, and you usually do.
I think Blake, in my opinion, is as good a networker as there is and the best fundraiser I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Well, that's very gracious. You know, if you think about this business in general, the venture business, you know, at the end of the day, you have to have trust.
Yeah.
The entrepreneurs have to trust you. Other VCs have to trust you. And I will tell you, some of my closest friends are people that I met in this industry. Yeah. Like people who I like to like go to dinner with, we exchange Christmas cards, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's been a huge blessing in my life because I've met some of the most fascinating, interesting people in the world.
Yeah, I think it's important for entrepreneurs to know and to understand that during the negotiations of a venture investor investing in a company, you're on two sides.
Right. Okay.
Buys and sells. I think it's too expensive. He or she thinks it's too cheap. But whatever. Once that investment is made, you're on the same side. Mm-hmm. And you have, you know, three groups there. You have the investors, you have the employees, and you have the founders. But they're all looking for the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important for everybody to understand that. The valuation when money is put in is not the valuation at the exit. Mm-hmm. And
well, That was one of the great lessons I learned from Jim. So my very first deal that I did at Pelion Utah Ventures was a company called Riverbed Technologies.
That was number one?
Dude,
you should have just retired after Riverbed.
Didn't own enough.
that was the first deal I did. And, you know, we got introduced to the company. And by the way, company had no shipping product. And this is like 2003 or 2004.
Yeah, that box got so hot you could cook an egg on it.
My first board meeting I went to, the VP of engineering reports that we caught a data center on fire. And I like went in the bathroom and threw up. And Jim Schwartz, who was on the board with me, put his arm around me and said, "We'll be fine." But I remember Jim telling me, so we have our term sheet in, we're going to lead this round of financing. It was my first deal. And by the way, keep in mind, like I wanted to pay $20 million valuation. And at that time, that was like an astronomical high valuation. And the CEO wanted 30. And we're going back and forth. And I was ready to walk away from the deal. By the way, we ended up doing the deal at $24 million. But Jim put his arm around me and he said, "Here's what I'm going to tell you is, the difference between $4 million valuation and if this company is successful, we're not going to care."
Yeah.
If this thing goes to hell in a handbasket, it's an extra percentage point for us. And it's $4 million. That was our first check. We don't care. And it was like this great lesson that I've tried to impart on my younger team members is, look, you don't want to be nuts when it comes to valuation, but if it works, you don't care. Mm-hmm. So it's this delicate dance. And that was like one of the very first lessons I learned from Jim. By the way, that company was wildly successful.
Crazy.
As Jim said, our biggest mistake was we didn't have enough money in it, but we were just still trying to figure things out.
So they were pre-sales. What convinced you to put a check in?
So they were pre-sales about 6 months away. Jerry Kennelly, who's the CEO, when he came to present to us, his first statement to us was, "I make data move faster than the speed of light." Think about that for just a minute. That's
it's ambitious.
Yeah, it's ambitious and it actually can't happen.
Yeah.
And so like we heard that and we're like, "Oh my gosh, this guy either is completely nuts or this is an amazing vision."
And maybe both.
Which, like most entrepreneurs.
Yeah, we can go down the list of people. Mm-hmm. And so that's what got us intrigued about it. And then we understood the science behind the tech behind it. And, you know, we just took a leap of faith, and this is, you know, being at a corporate venture fund, there's a lot more bumperels than being out here and and, you know, having somebody like Jim kind of mentor me and kind of walk me through. He's like, dude, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You're going to be okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, it's interesting to hear you talk about the psychology on the investor side of 20 pre versus 30 pre, which, by the way, my first round was a 250K pre. So, like, I did not know what I was doing. And Trotta's, their first round was a million pre. I think Josh's first round was a million pre. So, just for some context there. I talk to entrepreneurs every day about the psychology on their side, though, of the same thing, 20 versus 30. I've got this from, you know, this from this firm, this from this firm. And it's just so hard to get people to realize, like, it doesn't actually matter. You have to pick the people you want to build a business with.
100%. Mm-hmm. In good times and in bad times. Because by definition, you're going to have difficult times during that time frame that you're going to be in business together.
Yeah.
So do you have those people that are the same team with you, that have the same goal as you do, that you can be both good and bad times?
Yeah.
Picking the right people is much more important than the valuation.
Yeah, it's so spot on. I think some people get so hung up on ownership, like how much I own of this thing. And, you heard me say earlier, you know, our mistake with Riverbed is we didn't put enough money in. You know, we owned 12% when that company went public. But we owned about the same amount as the two founders. They each owned about 10 or 15% of that company. And I remember you got a $3 billion market cap at the IPO. And think about what that meant to those two founders. Sure. You know, and their comment was, you know what? Maybe we'd earned, you know, owned more, but maybe our exit would have been $300 million.
Absolutely.
And so like it was a really interesting conversation. And for us as investors, you always say, oh, I wish I'd owned more of that company. By the way, I own companies that have, we own 25% that were shutting down. So I'm more than happy to trade that 25% for 2% over here.
Well, right. I think the point you made too, Jim, is when an investment's made, all three parties are on the same side. They should be. I've worked with a bunch of founders as well. And I think the thing that a lot of people overlook for valuations, for how much of the company they own, is just the ability to have a network based on whoever's investing. So if you have questions about the industry that you're working through and trying to figure out how to navigate it, you need to hire specific people. I think that's the other thing that I see happen a lot of times is they forget about the network that the venture capitalists actually bring.
You know, it's so true. I mean, just I've been doing this for 25 plus years, Jim doing a lot longer than that. And the money's the least. We just show up with a bag of money and put it in. And I give you two for instances. You know, so we had one of our CEOs call us on the phone. He's a first-time CEO. And he said, I found this great product manager. I want to hire him. Great. I'm going to give him 10% of the company. And we're like, okay, let's have a longer conversation at this point. He just didn't know.
Yeah,
like that's what it was. And then I had another CEO during the same era who it was actually Tom Linnabus over at Sosta, you know, which Jim was part of. And he'd done IPOs, M&As, bankruptcy, the whole works. He'd call me on the phone. He said, look, don't say anything. I need talk for, and he'd talk for 30 minutes. Therapy session was over with. We'd hang up the phone. That was it. So they all need different things. Mm-hmm. Like this one entrepreneur was like, okay, he just needed some like guidance around this. What Tom didn't need a lot of strategy advice from me. Mm-hmm. What he needed was a listening ear. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and when I tell those two stories, you didn't hear me say money once. Mm-hmm. So it's not about the investment, it's about the cash.
Jim, favorite investment you were ever involved in? I'm putting you on the spot.
From founding it to seeing the exit to what we did good for the world, I'd say Sonic Innovations for me personally.
Okay.
I mean, I put it together, brought these schools together. I loved the co-investors. Outcome was good, not great.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked Anesta, which was drug delivery in the mouth. Again, great CEO, great team. But yeah, I think it would have to be Sonic.
Okay. Blake, same question.
Yeah, you heard me tell the Riverbed story.
Yeah.
And the little side note to that story here is, so We're negotiating the term sheet. I fly to San Francisco. I'm having dinner with Jerry, and we're literally across the street in some restaurant from Pac Bell Stadium or wherever the Giants play, whatever that stadium is called today. And Jerry kind of is like, all right, here's what the terms need to look like. And I get up. I'm like, all right, well, give me 5 minutes. I get up and I go call. I call Jim on the phone. I call our other partner, Carl, on the phone. I'm like, all right, here's what I got. And both of them are like, do it. And like that allowed us to win the deal. Yeah. And I threw up because of catching a data center on fire. I had the oh shit board meeting.
Yeah.
I was mentored by a bunch of just like Jim Schwartz, who's one of the icons in our industry. Yeah. He was my mentor on that board. Like I was just a young dude.
Yeah.
And you know, Jim was heavily involved. Jim Schwartz was heavily involved with Jim Schwartz. Just, I mean, you guys are just friends from decades ago. So to me, that was the best one because I experienced every emotion, including being involved when that company went public. Mm. And so
rang the bell.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. So fast forward to today, Pelion. I mean, you guys are one of the iconic firms here in the state. I'm sure you're doing plenty outside. What's the firm look like today? What are some of the investments you're really excited about, maybe locally or outside of the state?
Yeah. So, you know, when I joined Jim, there was eight of us. And I would say Jim was in building mode. We were in building mode. So roll forward today, we got 25 employees. Our latest fund is $370 million.
It's amazing.
I think when I joined Jim, it was fund three, you had $120 million.
Yep.
So the evolution has been that today, 58% of our companies are based in the state of Utah.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
It's so amazing. And you know, your question, here's how I answer your question is, it's like asking me which one of my kids is the favorite. So
we know.
There's always one.
There's always one. Yeah, absolutely.
Depends on the day.
Totally. You know, so what I'll say is, you know, we were the first institutional investor in this company called Divvy. Mm-hmm. So Blake Murray, and that's a fun story all on its own. But we went through everything with that company, every emotion, like the heart of COVID. We got to lay people off. All of a sudden it's working to, you know, getting an offer to sell that company for $1.5 billion, turning it down, which my young partner, Ben, was just like, oh my gosh, what did we just do? And I shared Riverbed. We had an offer for $365 million to sell that company and we turned it down. Once again, I was like, what are we doing here, people? Mm-hmm. Roll forward. We sell Divvy to Bill.com for $2.5 billion. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing outcome. You know, when I think about the three founders of Neighbor, you know, they walk in and they're like this story about storing stuff in your house. And mm-hmm. I was like, Jim, I'll never forget this.
I do not get it.
I looked at the partners. I said, are you guys kidding me? I don't want people putting their junk in my house. And so I call my kids on the phone. They're like, oh, that's a great idea. My partners then came in to me and said, you realize you're not the target market, right? So I got out of the way. We make that investment. Right. Company's been on. So those are the sorts of things. You know, we got this company called Nursa.
You know, oh, yeah.
It's a marketplace for nurses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of roll back to some of the roots that we had when we were doing a lot of life sciences stuff with Jim. And we look at what that company is doing. And then you hear the stories of both on the doctor side and on the nurse side. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the company. It's how they're impacting not only their own lives, but patients' lives. And this tech's allowing them to do it. So there's just a couple examples. And by the way, you know, if we had all day, I could go down a list of these businesses.
Sure.
What you're hearing is they're all in Utah. Magic is happening mm-hmm. here. It's amazing.
100%.
You know, and then the last thing I'd say is those Entrada guys, they're just absolutely amazing.
I like that.
I have to correct an earlier statement. You are an investor in Entrada. So I lied.
Yeah.
I lied.
Yeah. And you know what? You helped us get into this deal because it wasn't easy getting in. So thank you.
Blake's always been there for me. You're the guy I call every time I make a career move or retire or unretire. I call Blake and chat it through with him. So, Jim, maybe one final question for you. Just, you know, we're going through a little bit of a downturn. You know, you've lived through a few of these. You've watched entrepreneurs. You've given advice to entrepreneurs through a few of these. Any thoughts you'd have for kind of people in building businesses now, probably doing layoffs for the first time, which is a really hard and emotional thing to go through for everyone involved. But just, you know, you know, anything you would advise people as they're kind of heading into this next year that's still probably going to be pretty bumpy?
Be very careful about saving cash. Mm-hmm. Cash is king now. And don't try to do it on your own. Go to your board of directors, go to your friends, reach out of the company, ask for advice. The thing that I was able to do as a young man when I started this fund is I was able to go and ask people that had a great deal of experience, Peter Criss, Bob Pavey, Jim Schwartz. That is no different today than it was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So just make sure that you make these decisions collectively.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And because those people will be there to help you if that decision was not exactly 100% right. Mm-hmm.
It's good advice. Like, I've got that personality trait. I think a lot of founders probably do. A lot of executives do. The worse I am, the more I isolate. And it's absolutely 100%. The worst thing you can do.
You can't.
Yeah, if you think about the CEO job, it is the loneliest job on the planet. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't matter how many great friends you have around. So it's, you're already lonely. And what you need to look around is your directors or great advisors. I mean, you've had those over the years, Adam, is like, how can they not make it so lonely?
Mm-hmm.
And he's right. Like nothing beats cash, you know, because with cash, guess what? You get a fight to live another day.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, this economy will turn around. We saw it with Jim's been around longer than me, but I saw the internet bubble burst and come back. I saw the financial crisis meltdown, and what comes out of there are great companies. Mm-hmm. I mean, out of the financial crisis meltdown, we invested in this little company called Cloudflare. You know, Matthew Prince and Michelle Zeitlin and Lee Holloway, unbelievable entrepreneurs. When they told us their vision was to power the internet, like, holy crap, that could be pretty interesting. But it came on the heels of the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to go look, but I think that company's got like a $30 billion market cap today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, our first investment was $800,000 in 2009.
Yeah, 8 or 9.
Yeah, wow. Something like that.
Were you the first money in Cloudflare?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I don't think that is one company everyone listening to this does know, and that many probably don't know that Pelion was the first money in Cloudflare.
I had no idea.
So yeah. Matthew Prince is from Salt Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. Then was living in San Francisco, and we had a connection to him.
Yeah.
And he made a presentation, and we all jumped on it.
If you know Ben Dahl, who's great. So Ben and Matthew went to Roland Hall together. So they grew up together.
I didn't know that.
And Matthew and Michelle and Lee were at Harvard, and they were working on this business plan, and they were using their friend Ben, who was working at Pelion at the time, using their friend Ben as a sounding. And Ben brought him in, and then we all sat down collectively as a group and looked at what they were doing. And once again, a big, bold statement to say, we're going to power the internet.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I think that's part of this whole, you know, power the internet faster than the speed of light, like all of that sort of stuff. And yeah, we wrote the first $800,000. I think you introduced him to Ray Rothrock over at Venrock. Mm-hmm. And so Venrock, so it was a $2 million round of financing. We did 800 grand. We introduced them to Venrock. They wanted to be, we're going to do $1 million a piece, but Venrock wanted to be the big dog. So we said, all right, we're good with 800 grand. So,
wow. Yeah. What was the valuation on that? Do you remember?
It was 4 million pre, 6 million post.
Wow.
For Cloudflare.
It's amazing.
When
that company went public, we had the good fortune of owning nearly 20% of that company.
And we'd gotten offered to sell it too.
Yeah.
Was that number one investment you guys ever did from an ROI? Cloudflare?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like,
amazing.
It made the fund. It made Fund 4 be one of the biggest all-time returning funds in U.S. history.
So our fourth fund has a 10x net, meaning that's the money we've returned to our investors. And Cloudflare was like, it's an amazing company. And those three founders are all just fantastic people. I mean, Matthew, I think, spending a lot of time up in Park City, likes to ski.
See my jazz games occasionally.
Michelle's actually come and actually done some mentoring for some of the students here locally. Two of my partners, Chad Packard and Ben Lambert, actually teach a class at one of the universities, and Michelle's come in and talk. So they're just fantastic people.
I was going to say that, and we can cut this if I'm wrong, but I do see Matt at jazz games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A bunch. I don't know him, but I know of him. And then Jim Schwartz also lives in Park City of Excel. Is that right or is that wrong?
He's had a house there for 25 or 30 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. But a lot of the VCs have houses up there now and have for 25 years.
Yeah.
It's easy to get to from San Francisco.
Yeah.
I'm leaving Novell because I decide I want to be a VC. I schedule a breakfast at the Stein Erickson Lodge with Jim Schwartz because I was an LP in a couple of their funds. And I used to hang out at their offices. I'm sitting there having breakfast with Jim and I'm trying to figure this stuff out. And Schwartz goes to me and goes, "You need to meet my friend Jim Dreyfuss." Mm. And I said, "Okay." So it was right during the Olympics. So Dreyfuss was heavily involved with the 2002 Olympics. So this was kind of leading up to that. And so Jim and I start talking through an introduction by Jim Schwartz over a breakfast that we had at Stein Erickson Lodge. Oh, cool. Now, I don't know what conversations Schwartz and Dreyfuss were having in the background. I thought they were both being nice to me.
and then Blake and I go to our first lunch to Lone Star Taqueria. And they weren't accepting credit cards at the time. Neither of us had cash. So we were trying to go in through our ashtrays in our cars, finding quarters and things. I think we had to give the guy an IOU and told him I'd be back in a couple hours with money.
Two of us, we're managing $500 million. If you haven't been to Lone Star Taqueria, by the way,
yeah, they have the best burritos.
Best burritos. Yeah. We go in there, we order, and they don't take credit cards. I have no cash. Mm-hmm. Jim has no cash. We go out to our cars. I got like 3 cents in an ashtray. Jim writes up an IOU. They give us our food. And I think Jim had to go back later that afternoon to give him cash.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm.
I will say for me, from my standpoint, looking at Pelion today versus what it could have become is the diversity that Blake has put around the table at Pelion is very impressive, especially considering the demographics that we have in Utah.
Yeah.
You know, more women, people of color, people, different age groups, different experiences. He's done a very conscious decision of what kind of people to hire and why and how it helps. And it helps not only the Utah ecosystem, but it will help the ecosystem wherever they invest.
Well, it makes total sense. You talked about getting out of the way with neighbor.
Yeah.
You're not the demographic. You need to make sure you have people around the table who can help advise on those situations.
Well, that's the thing is, the young cool kids in the firm, like they got it.
Yeah.
And and if I had to stay, like, this was one thing I learned from Jim is like, turn people loose. Like you don't stifle creativity. And I had a choice at that point. It's like, I could either say no, or I get out of the way and let it go. And by the way, you know, that $1 million we put into Neighbor, that company is going to be amazing. But it never would have happened if I hadn't like just got out of the way.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Making mistakes are great. Yeah. You just have to give everybody the chance to make a mistake, make sure that they learn something from it, and not make that same mistake, hopefully, again.
So true.
Love that.
Is there any stories we need to get Jim telling before we turn you guys loose? Can you think of anything, Blake? It can even be PG-13 rated, whatever you need.
Jim's walkabout was a journey all by itself.
Wait, was that a legit walkabout?
I had a hard time after Wayne Brown was killed. I went and saw most of my investors, asked them for what I should do, spent a lot of time in the mountains or outside in Mother Nature, whatever you want to call her.
Yeah.
Did a lot of practicing of meditation because I didn't know is it better when you have something like that happen when I am not trained as a technologist like Blake was? Mm-hmm. Is it better for me to say, turn back the money? Right. Not try to do this on your own.
Right.
I didn't know where I was going to go. And, you know, thank goodness I met one of the great people I've ever known is David Evans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he introduced me to the Ashtons and to Ray Norden. But that was a really difficult time.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you think about that for just a minute, let's say.
But it was a good time.
Yeah. Let's say the decision by Jim would have been turn the money back. Like he was the first VC for a long time in the state of Utah. Like we might be in a very different world today. because, you know, his imprint on, you know, his friends from Zions Bank, his imprint, like he funded Paul Alstrom's company, Nolix.
Oh, right.
You know, so Jim was the money behind Nolix. And so, you know, he had touch points with the Vspring guys. And so if you think about that moment in time, if it hadn't, if Jim hadn't like gone and on the walkabout, talked to his VC, spent time, his LPs wouldn't have given him that time, we might be sitting in a different world mm-hmm. as it relates to the VC. I know Pelion wouldn't be what it is.
Yeah. Today. It's crazy to think of these little teeny things like Jim not quitting, yeah. David Evans convincing Alan Ashton to go into computer science.
Yeah.
Alan convincing Bruce Bastian to switch from band to computer science. Little teeny things that happened that really just completely changed the landscape of Utah.
When, and, you know, and
magic.
Yeah.
You know, Drew Major and the Superset guys mm-hmm. figuring mm-hmm. it out with Novell. Novell was a hardware company. They sold that stuff off. You know, and then you think about what the guys have done today, be it, you know, Ryan or Josh or mm-hmm. Sconner. I mean, the list goes on of like great entrepreneurs. And now there's that next generation of guys like you, Adam, and Blake Murray and Brandon Rodman and Eric Ray. And like, it just goes on and on. Like it's we're all connected in some mm-hmm. way, because none of this stuff would have happened had you rolled all the way back and
yeah.
think, you know,
yeah.
we'd have been on a different trajectory.
But so. The advantage you have now, as Blake said, there was three generations or something mm-hmm. and you're in the next generation. There is an ecosystem now
yeah.
of many people. Before, there were three entrepreneurs running tech companies yeah. in Utah and four entrepreneurs running life science companies. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the economy of scale.
Yeah.
And Utah has it, and we're going to get it more. Mm-hmm. And I think this is going to be as good a place in the country to invest in tech.
I think you're right. As we started doing research, the web of people who exist in companies today and date all the way back to the first generation, second generation, it's pretty incredible. It'll look totally different.
I'd love to see that web.
Yeah. You know, STP, same 10 people. You know, that's what it was back then.
Pretty much.
We could go to the same 10 people. And, you know, today, as you said, we need a CFO. There's a whole bunch of them.
Yeah.
You know, we need a CEO. There's a whole bunch of them. Mm-hmm. You know, and by the way, recruiting people into the state of Utah is super easy.
You know.
It wasn't like that back then.
It was hard.
Yeah. Really hard.
Well, we can end on that now, but I just want to say, Jim, thank you for not quitting.
Thank you.
I think everyone in Utah owes you a huge thank you as really the founder of venture capital in Utah. And I think you chose the right guy here to hand the keys to whenever that was over the last decade.
I would just ask you one question. Entrepreneurs never quit.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So. That's the key. I mean, you know, all those entrepreneurs you mentioned, every one of them have a story around, you know, about
failure.
They should have just stopped.
Yeah, 100%.
Like it didn't make sense to keep going, and you just keep figuring one problem out at a time.
Yep.
Well, thanks to both of you. Thanks for what
guys.
You represent
you.
To the state and everything that you've done. And to me personally, what you meant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks again.
Thanks, guys.